The rich people want to keep their wealth, right? And maybe they get to Bitcoin too late. And
I'm totally fine with the government just keeping its hands off Bitcoin completely. And the only real way out is...
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Bitstein in the house, who had an amazing talk just at BitBlock Boom. But Bitstein, there's been a lot of interesting discussions around Bitcoin in the Oval Office. So as a Bitcoin OG, when they're talking about the monetary policy like they are, does it surprise you that they've reached Bitcoin this early and that seemingly the government is looking for every single way possible to scoop up as much Bitcoin?
I haven't been doing a great job of keeping up with every move that's going on. I know that Bo Hines has been pumping Bitcoin very, very bigly, as they say, and in a huge way. So the fact that that's happening, I'm not surprised. Perhaps it's surprising that it's reached this stage this quickly. Sometimes it feels like Bitcoin is, you know, going slower than I imagined it would way back in the day. But at other times, it feels very accelerated. And I do feel like over the past few years, we've reached one of these acceleration periods where Bitcoin has gone, you know, I think basically starting in 2020 with the big introduction of Michael Saylor and Bitcoin as a serious treasury reserve asset, you know, for corporations, that naturally starts to bleed over into governments. I would say that, you know, every person, every organization is effectively facing the same basic problems in the world of, you know, needing to have money so they can save it for the future and be able to spend it. You know, have money that they can actually use to stay out of debt and so on and so forth. And, you know, it starts with the plebs early on, trying to get out of, you know, there's plenty of old stories of people using Bitcoin to get out of student, loan debt and, get out of like a mortgage that was, you know, keeping them under. And, you know, that's bled up into the corporations. And I think once that happens, it's natural that it would start to bleed up into, you know, the government level. And yeah, I mean, money is something that literally every organization needs. So it was only a matter of time before government started to see that. And, you know, I think a lot of people, they tend to think only on the sort of the anti-Bitcoin perspective of you have central banks that want to keep their power. Therefore, you know, the government's just going to shut all of this down. They don't want to give up their power. At the same time, Bitcoin has obvious advantages for those who partake in it. So, you know, there's all sorts of principal agent problems for those organizations. And, you know, the actual scope of people in the government that have an explicit agenda against having a you know, a competing sort of treasury asset is going to be very, very slim. So the people are going to naturally start gravitating towards Bitcoin as they come to understand it. And I think the past 4 years have offered many opportunities to learn more about the advantages of Bitcoin, what makes Bitcoin special, the fact that, you know, everyone's dealing with inflation, and when you start to understand that the nature of Bitcoin is that it's anti-inflation, you know, these are very attractive, and it's very attractive to anyone who needs money, which is everyone. So yeah, it was a matter of time, and I am happy to see that the vibe, shall we say, in DC has changed dramatically, even within, you know, say the Trump administration from the 2016 Trump administration versus the 2024 Trump administration. The change in their perception and interest in Bitcoin, it's changed dramatically. And I think it's very exciting that right now people are actually open-minded to Bitcoin in a very positive way. That doesn't mean that I don't think that there's a lot of education that needs to happen, bad ideas that need to be pushed back on and so forth. But it does give a much better prognosis on the future of Bitcoin when they're actually willing to hear the, like, you know, our side of it, as opposed to just seeing it as something that needs to be destroyed. So I think it's a very positive development, and I think people should, where they can, make use of the fact that people are willing to listen. I've been quite surprised by, some of the interactions I've managed to have within both state and federal politics. Not that I do that much or anything, but some of the conversations that I've found myself in just by happenstance, the outcome of those conversations were much more positive than I would have ever imagined. And my friend Pierre Richard likes to point out that we don't change Bitcoin; Bitcoin changes us. And so it is interesting to see and to consider how people's minds might change over time as they become more comfortable with Bitcoin, as they start buying Bitcoin, not just on an organizational level, but also on a personal level, because if they realize it's, it fits into some policy for the United States or, the state of Florida, the state of Texas, et cetera, they have natural reason to then also think, well, how could it benefit myself? And so these things go hand in hand. And I think it's good to remain, positive, and just, recognize where more education does or doesn't, I don't even think there is any, a doesn't, there's always more to learn, but recognize, where more education probably is needed.
Yeah. And I think that is great. There's a lot to unpack there. And I want to dive into the corporation level kind of, the evolution that you've seen with MicroStrategy and now turning to Strategy and others. But first, you brought up an interesting point about, the potential of, people getting out of student loan debts, mortgages, and everything else with Bitcoin. Now, It might not happen, or there might be some difficulties there, but do you think that there is a future or a world where the US could pay off their debt using Bitcoin, or on the flip side of things, just print money to buy more Bitcoin and then, I guess, in a sense, almost inflate their own bags?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's within the realm of possibility. I don't want to ascribe any probabilities or anything, but it's within the realm of possibility that the national debt could get taken care of with a proper Bitcoin treasury policy and strategy. So I don't see why it wouldn't be possible. But yes, they need to be, if they want to do that, they would have to start being aggressive about it now, and continually find new ways to increase their balance. And of course, I would say that any of the increases should not be at the expense of Americans. A lot of people are concerned about chance of confiscation and such, and I don't think that has to even be part of the program, and obviously I don't think it should be part of the program to do it. But there's all sorts of things that people are talking about, things like bit bonds as a way to basically spur an investment that leads to a greater amount of Bitcoin on the balance sheet. And the more you can push that, the more you're strengthening the financial foundations of the country. And honestly, putting us plebs in many ways at less risk, because they don't have to come attack us for Bitcoin. They can just be a MicroStrategy type organization rather than a bunch of looters.
Self-custody can be a daunting task. That's why I've partnered with Bitbox. They have the best hardware wallet. They make it the easiest to put Bitcoin in self-custody. So go to bitbox.swiss/greencandle today and use promo code greencandle and you can get 5% off your entire order. They make it so easy, all in one. You could get the hardware wallet. You could get their punch plates. You could do it all right there on that website to make the self-custody experience the easiest it can be. So visit bitbox.swiss/greencandle. Use promo code greencandle. Get 5% off your entire order and get your Bitcoin off an exchange into self-custody today. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show. Now let's dive into the MicroStrategy situation here, because I mean, Michael Saylor has just been buying, it seems like, every single week here to start the year, and he continues to double, triple, quadruple, whatever down, finding every single strategy underneath the sun to buy more Bitcoin. Now, how have you noticed, like, I guess the evolution just of MicroStrategy now turned strategy? One, just kind of like the persona or the perception of all of this, and what's your viewpoint, I guess, on more of these corporations starting to come on and, you know, I guess dip their toe in the water, so to speak, with Bitcoin on the balance sheet?
Well, I think the first thing is Bitcoin on the balance sheet is a reasonable thing for every human on earth, so it's natural that companies ought to be gravitating towards it. I'm not an expert on all of these financial companies. I'm not, broadly speaking, a financial guy. I'm interested in sort of the theory of money, but not as much like, you know, kind of Wall Street type financial stuff. That being said, like on a broad scale, what's interesting to me is just having watched this develop as a strategy, because, you know, early on in Bitcoin, everything was about trying to encourage, people wanted to spend Bitcoin. So it's like the thing that was exciting for people was the idea of a company accepting Bitcoin as payment. Now, the problem with that, of course, is people don't want to give up their sats because they see such a bright future in Bitcoin that the price would go up, and whatever they're going to be buying with those sats is not as valuable to them as having future sats. So people don't really spend their Bitcoin. So, you'd have companies that might accept Bitcoin, but they actually, you know, stop because it's too much of a hassle at the time to accept Bitcoin. And then on top of that, people aren't even using it. So what's the point? And that was sort of the main thing. And, you know, we've been arguing for a long time that the real sort of foundational value in Bitcoin comes from the reservation demand that people have. So the fact that people want to hold Bitcoin in their cash balance, and the more that grows, that's sort of the thing that gets the whole economic engine of Bitcoin adoption growing, because that's sort of value and induced by the people who see that bright future in Bitcoin, that sort of entrepreneurial vision of this thing can be so great in the future. Those are the people who are going to be willing to take on the risk to just hold it on their cash balance and hold it for the long run. And that kicks off a lot of economic action by virtue of it increasing the price of Bitcoin, which then makes it more interesting as a currency. A currency is more valuable when it's more liquid. And that increase in the price has effects like, you know, getting people to, start taking on projects that they weren't able to before, because now they find themselves having saving. They They get things like, you know, the wealth effect where people, you know, feel richer, so they do want to spend. So now that, you know, you've gone through a couple cycles, you feel a desire to sort of, you know, take some of the profit and enjoy the profits. And so that actually creates opportunities for entrepreneurs who want to accept Bitcoin as payment for stuff. So that's kind of the core thing. And so what was really neat and so exciting about seeing Michael Saylor show up on the sort of global stage in the way that he has was that he was demonstrating that as the corporate strategy, as opposed to merely just accepting Bitcoin. And there's nothing wrong with accepting Bitcoin. There's many reasons that people should accept Bitcoin as payment and such. But in terms of really making a splash in and driving Bitcoin adoption, the corporate balance sheet strategy is almost something that it just no one was really quite thinking about that until Michael Saylor. And he has just shown the world that this is a viable thing to do. And I think right now we're watching everyone learning from that. And all of the ways that he is coming up with to find, you know, all the extra pennies under the cushions, or, you know, just the new ways of offering, you know, various financial instruments. All of these are finding ways to open up Bitcoin exposure to many different people who have different risk profiles, different kind of long-term you know, desires. Some people want highly leveraged Bitcoin and hope that the Bitcoin price is going to go up and they're going to get really rich really fast. Other people want more of a, you know, kind of fixed income kind of thing. And he's finding a way to create a financial product for all of those people so that as they're thinking about these economic decisions, they're doing it with a Bitcoin standard in mind. And it's sort of a Bitcoin standard that's driving those decisions, even when it's not, you know, what some of the, you know, more purist Bitcoiners would view as pure Bitcoin, because they're, you know, maybe not, you know, if you have a MicroStrategy or a Strategy financial product, obviously you're not holding your own keys, et cetera, et cetera. But those are people who are still exposing themselves to Bitcoin as a on the grounds of a Bitcoin standard. And so, yeah, the fact that he's done that is great. And I love watching other people learn from this. I think he has been a great teacher, not just in terms of words. I mean, he's been on so many podcasts and really shaped people's ideas through sort of direct education, but also the process of building this business in this way and showing it as a successful strategy. That itself is highly educational, and you can't deny the numbers. You can quibble with ideas that come out of people's mouths, but at the end of the day, you either did better in the market than him or you did not. And you have to take anyone who's managing money has to deal with the ramifications of that and reconsider their own strategies in light of what is happening. So I'm broadly speaking, you know, very, very excited about all of that. And I think that there's a lot of TradFi that is stuck in TradFi. And if all of that can be effectively redenominated into onto a Bitcoin standard, that is a wonderful thing for the future of our global economy and the future of Bitcoin in particular.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You can go to the bitcoinwell.com/greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens. You flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks. 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000, and they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada, and on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage, and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin, and that's self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today. Enough for me, back to the show. Yeah, 100%. And it seems like the game theory is starting to play out, whether it's governments or businesses now accepting Bitcoin. Do you see it that way? Or do you still think, you know, we're still early, so to speak, as we love to say in the Bitcoin space, and we've still got a long ways to go?
Well, I do think that we're objectively still early in the sense that, you know, at its peak, Bitcoin was, you know, reaching over, $2 trillion. And to us, that seems like a lot of money. Obviously, none of us are ever going to see $2 trillion. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. There could be a future where, you could, your whatever sats you have could be worth $2 trillion. But you understand what I'm saying. It's like, in terms of the global economic pie, $2 trillion is really a drop in the bucket. And so there is still so much, economic value that can be absorbed into Bitcoin that sort of, I would say, ought to be absorbed into Bitcoin. I think it would, you know, probably liquidate a lot of just cruft that our economy has, lots of things being treated as savings accounts that shouldn't be treated as savings accounts, but are, because the fiat money continually devalues, and so they need to escape, not because they get something out of it, but because they need to beat inflation. All of that stuff can be absorbed into Bitcoin. And so when we look at that on the grand scale, I'm not going to tell you, you know, like what specific number we're going to or anything like that, but it's very clear that we are very early. That being said, we've also made it a long way, and we shouldn't forget that fact. We should be excited about, we should just be excited about the journey as a whole.
Yeah. So, you've talked about Michael Saylor with like the education of money and everything else, whether it's on his podcast or everything else. Obviously, he's been, you know, pictured with Eric Trump in the White House, and he seems to have a decent amount of influence when it comes to this, this team here, Trump 2024 team. With that, you've been tweeting a little bit about, government's efficiency and essentially not needing anything like income tax. Now, do you think that Bitcoin has essentially played a role in this, where now, you know, we're essentially getting back to what America was almost run on initially, like the taxation without representation, like, you know, whether it's getting the money from the tariffs or whatever we're going to do, but essentially not needing to tax the public in order to, you know, have a prospering economy? Do you think that that's where we're headed? Or do you think that that's just, a pipe dream here? And maybe we'll get close, or at least closer than we are right now. But the world of no income tax and kind of moving forward like that might be a little bit too much.
I would point out, you know, as far as things like income tax, I am against it, no matter the, like, how rich or poor we are. I think that it's unjust to take people's income away from them. But as far as like a feasible policy, the way that the Trump administration talks is that they themselves would like to sort of get rid of the IRS. They would prefer getting revenues through things like tariffs, which are a sort of indirect tax on people, because it's you have to pay the price of goods coming in. But at least, you know, on the bright side, with a setup like that, while you're still being taxed, you're not having to create a financial panopticon to track your every economic move in order to make sure that you are giving the government what they believe they deserve. But you know, I'm against the income tax on more ethical grounds than I am specifically on you know, policy grounds. Like, it's just it is the policy that there should be no income tax. So I don't know if there's some other way that I'm not getting the question that.
No, I mean, I think you're nailing it, because I think, you know, Bitcoin kind of, I guess, in a sense, like, changes the way, you know, we think about the overall, you know, policy, the hard money standards and everything else. So I guess, you know, in a hyper Bitcoinized world, how do you think we get there? Do you think we need to, I guess, suffer some pain in the current system that we're at? You know, because I see it kind of as two paths. I think one path, you know, we have destruction, everything goes to shit. We essentially need, you know, Bitcoin to save us. But in the interim, everything is terrible. And then on the other side of things, there's the slow, the gradual kind of move over towards Bitcoin, where people are using it in, you know, businesses and everything else. And then, you know, eventually we get to a Bitcoin standard, but it takes, you know, a few years to get there, opposed to just crashing and burning the current system. How do you see us kind of getting there?
Well, so if we were on a Bitcoin standard, and if the government had acquiesced to such a thing, if that's the case, then my hope is that they've come to realize, you know, the value of basically Bitcoin balance sheets and all of that. And with that, the policy move, because of course, like, even on a Bitcoin standard, that doesn't mean that the government couldn't still have an income tax. However, if you have a Bitcoin standard, it does make it a bit more difficult to make it sort of politically feasible to continue, or palatable to be continuing to take money, because it's like, well, why aren't you just saving the money you have? You know, there's we kind of live in this mess where they get to print a bunch of money, and everyone is sort of, they're unaware, they actually sort of almost have a Stockholm syndrome for the money printer and the economic system as it is. And one hope would be that if everyone is starting to think on Bitcoin terms, they no longer see government financing in the same way. And so when the government comes and demands you give them more money, there's more pushback of saying, it's like, hey, you need to clean up your own act before I have any interest in giving you money. And so I think it might be more, there might be more political ways for, you know, the people to push back on these things on a policy level. But yeah, I like, if the government didn't have a national debt, and the government had a large stockpile of Bitcoin, and that stockpile of Bitcoin grew along with economic growth, it's like, well, that alone is more purchasing power every year that the government can use for the things they need to do. And so it's like, well, why do you need our money? You already have money. So, you know, my hope would be that the politics around that fact would change and change towards the better in terms of pushing back against the idea that they need more of our sats.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And I want to move into the realm of hyperinflation here, because, you know, you had an interesting tweet. Marty actually quote tweeted it the other day, saying the USD has turned the stock market into a normie shitcoin casino. And I completely agree with you, because, you know, somebody, I can't remember who it was or the exact quote here, but somebody essentially said, oh, you know, if Bitcoin goes from, you know, 100,000 to 250,000, I've only 2.5x'd my investment. And they were acting like that was not a good way to look at things. It seems like with the way that everything is going, you know, I have friends that are disappointed if the S&P 500 isn't giving them like a 20% return or something absolutely astronomical. Whereas, you know, 6 years ago, it was like 8 to 12% is a normal expected return. So, you know, do you think as we're starting to get into this phase where, you know, as Lawrence Laporte has written, there's the potential of the big print that we're just going to see massive amounts of hyperinflation? Or do you even think we could potentially be in that realm right now?
You know, I like to be hyperbolic and say that even 2% inflation is hyperinflation. Because you compound 2% over a long enough period of time, you know, 30 odd years, and you've already destroyed half of people's purchasing power. That is a, to me, that is an extremely rapid degradation of wealth. Just, dumping it, you know, down the, pouring it down the drain. So, you know, even 2% inflation should be viewed with, you know, extreme concern. The problem is most people have been trained to believe that we need 2% inflation because of, you know, some mumbo jumbo about how the economy grows, and so the prices need to go up, even though all of that, I would argue, is false. But so given that, you know, yeah, people in this sort of late stage fiat economy, people generally have to fight against inflation, and inflation compounds. And especially over the past few years, we've seen way more price increases following, you know, a supply inflation in 2020 of what, like a third of all money was printed. So it was sort of inevitable that prices were going to have to increase, and they could come up with all of the reasons they wanted to about it was actually because of Beyonce and Taylor Swift tickets or something like that, and greedy grocery store owners that prices were going up. But, you know, I would always point fingers to the fact that they printed a third of all money. So we've already at this point seen these large growths. Now, you know, I'm not a financial person to the point of being able to, you know, look and tell you is like what's going to happen next with the Fed. I like Bitcoin because I don't have to pay as close attention to that stuff. I can just stay humble and stack sats and make that my strategy instead of having to know what color tie Jerome Powell wore so that I can help, you know, decide how to make my, you know, what to do with 10-year treasury bonds or something. It's like, I don't want to live that life. So all that being said, yeah, we've been put in this situation where prices are increasing faster and faster, and people have to use that as the hurdle rate. And that just fundamentally changes people's perspectives. And so on the one hand, you really do have to work harder every year just to stay in place. And then on top of that, there's just an overall feeling of I need to get rich quick, because there is no way to just get rich slowly. You know, a person can't just go do their job, save some money, you know, spend less than they earn, and put that money away and know that they have a future. It's like suddenly you have to become, you know, a stock trader and get into real estate. And that's not what normal people should have to do. Normal people should just be able to live their lives, like, you know, do your job and do a good job and save for the future. But instead, we have to worry about where our, you know, are we going to be able to afford food? And so as this goes on, you know, yes, I mean, Michael Saylor, I think I sort of, I can roll with him on this idea that the S&P 500 sort of is the inflation rate. Like, that is the baseline inflation rate. And so that means it's the hurdle rate of what you need to get have to stay to get ahead. And so when people are expecting, you know, 8% returns, and now they're expecting 20, it's because not only do they want to, they like want to be able to stay in place and not have a lowering of their quality of life, but they also naturally want to make their lives better. And so it's hard to blame them when they're having such what feel like very unrealistic expectations, because they've been put in a situation where things are just constantly, the economic system as it is constantly chipping away at them. And the only real way out is Bitcoin and having something that they can't dilute, and just doing that, but doing it with a long-term view so that it can handle the volatility and get through it. But yeah, people have inflated expectations for sure.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Yeah, that is definitely a good way to put it, inflated expectations. But it's interesting that you say that, you know, the 2% inflation rate is essentially hyperinflation because of just the compounding. And I want to dive into that a little bit more because, you know, obviously we've had massive amounts of money printing, you know, 30% is the number that you stated just a bit earlier as well. And I mean, do you think like there's a way for us to get out of this situation without any money printing? And is that something that I guess, you know, worries you about the future of everything? Obviously, Bitcoin, you know, is kind of that safe haven and everything else. But, you know, we're not to the point where everybody has Bitcoin and everybody is, you know, a full-fledged Bitcoiner just yet. So the money printing, if it comes sooner, we'll start to see some more violent swings. So yeah, is that something that you're worried about here in the future?
There's definitely better people who would be able to talk about the money printing aspects, but my broad feeling is that as Bitcoin continues to seep in, I think of Bitcoin as the economic load balancer. So in the same way we think of like Bitcoin mining, right, where it's a load balancer on the grid, the Bitcoin miner can turn on and off as it needs to, depending on how much people need more electricity. So like, you know, when it's 5 p.m. on a hot summer day in Texas and everyone's turning on their air conditioners, all the Bitcoin miners can turn off while that's happening and the grid is able to keep going, you know, that kind of load balancing. I see Bitcoin as the economic load balancer. So it's sound money is the load balancer for the entire economy. So when people start to feel more uncertainty about the future, that's when they're going to start seeking out things like Bitcoin. And so I think I'm sure you can talk to people about scary things that could come our way, and I don't want to discount those possibilities. But I also I do want to point out that Bitcoin is the thing that whenever those bad possibilities are coming around, Bitcoin is here and it can absorb a lot of the economic problems as it should. And so I think that is going to allow a dampening as long as we can continue to educate people about the value of Bitcoin so that they use this as an option. If we continue to see people like all these corporations, if we continue to see them start adopting Bitcoin as a treasury asset, that also means that, you know, when money is printing and people are moving to kind of like harder assets, which is often, you know, real estate, equities, etc. Well, all of those equities, everyone's 401k accounts, everyone's just, you know, just all the different TradFi accounts that they have, they're actually becoming more Bitcoinized under the hood. So everything is still, you know, in dollar terms and such, but it's like, you know, MicroStrategy is literally just like a big pile of Bitcoin, and a lot of these other companies might also start becoming big piles of Bitcoin. So even though it's, you know, it's just like, you know, another stock ticker that someone's trying to chase after, even if they're thinking about it in that fiat way, they are getting Bitcoinized. And so those problems of if money is printed such that more people feel the need to go chase after equities, but those equities are themselves becoming more Bitcoinized, then that means that people are naturally, like, Bitcoin is acting as that load balancer and absorbing all of the you know, economic issues going on. You know, I think it's great that Bitcoin is able to do a lot of great sort of growth in peacetime, so to speak. And it's also going to do well, I think, in, you know, wartime when people are way more uncertain about the economics. So, there's potential for bad stuff. But I do want to, you know, posit Bitcoin as this load balancer that will absorb that. And so, you know, I think we should feel massively grateful that Bitcoin exists, because it means that we have this as an option. I think if Bitcoin didn't exist, I don't think I'd be able to be so cheery in this interview right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear you on that. And you do great work at the Nakamoto Institute and, you know, help a lot with like the education aspect of it. What do you think is the biggest hurdle for people to get over to, I guess, you know, fully understand, you know, I guess the economic shift behind Bitcoin? Because, you know, you always talk about the Wall Street trader on your Twitter about how, you know, they've been educated in finance for so long and they've almost been, you know, seemingly brainwashed at this point. So how are we going to get everybody on board to getting onto a Bitcoin standard?
So I tend to think that everyone's different. I don't think that there's one silver bullet to be able to get everyone interested in Bitcoin and see the light on Bitcoin and all of that. I think, you know, my theory of money is that money is meant to deal with future uncertainty. And the types of uncertainties that different people deal with are very different. And the work that people do is very different. So the very problems that they're thinking about are very different. Like an architect is not thinking about the same problems with, you know, the building materials and all of the stuff involved with building as the Wall Street guy, you know, versus the, you know, a software engineer versus a plumber versus, you know, this and that. There's many different things. And so this is actually what I love about the Bitcoin fixes this meme. Not literally just the deployment of the meme of Bitcoin fixes this, but what it represents, which is just recognizing that Bitcoin, by virtue of being money and dealing with money problems, is something that deals with basically all of the choices people are making in the economy and all of the problems that they're facing on the financial side. And so I think, you know, each group of people, each cohort, you know, is going to have its own needs of what it is needs to be shown to them about what Bitcoin is, how it works, how it helps them. I don't think there's a single one. With the Nakamoto Institute, I'm mostly focused on the, you know, long-term, you know, historical and economic, you know, arguments for Bitcoin. And all of these things are things that I think have to be more synthesized into the particular for particular groups. So, you know, I can go on about it's like, oh yeah, holding Bitcoin is great. And here are the economic effects, but it takes a special form of that argument to get through to a plumber to think through, you know, how his business works, how his personal life works by virtue of his business, and how holding Bitcoin makes sense within that context. And then you're also going to have, like, you know, the Wall Street guys. Now, those guys are the ones that have way more money, so we see a lot more of that as the general discussion, because it's much sort of higher stakes in terms of the consequences of their decisions on the economy as a whole, and so on and so forth. But this is something that literally applies to everyone from, you know, your neighbor to the president of the United States. You kind of have to tailor it to them.
Yeah, and I completely get it with that as well. But do you think, like, we're going to get to that kind of world where we're going to escape the Keynesian economic kind of system because of just, like, the people in power, essentially, you know, like Powell, like, they don't want to lose that power. Obviously, Bitcoin's going to win eventually, and it seems like it's going to be trending in that direction, at least in the short term. But, you know, people like the rich people want to keep their wealth, right? And maybe they get to Bitcoin too late and they don't want to see this new rise of the plebs who got in earlier, the Bitcoin OGs. So, you know, is that something where, you know, do you think we're at that, I guess, gradually then suddenly area that Parker Lewis describes? Or are we at the now they fight us kind of stage, but it's just, hey, we're given that illusion that everything's okay?
Well, you know, Keynesianism won because it was useful to those in power. You know, I'm not going to, like, argue that people in power don't want to keep power. But as I said before, there's sort of a principal agent problem of, you know, if someone just wants to keep power, you know, they're not going to be as ideological about what they need. They would be willing to change ideologies if it meant they were getting rich. So if Bitcoin is growing as something, and actually now the way to make big moves for the future is actually to embrace, you know, Bitcoin and Austrian economics and such, because when you do that, you stand to gain a large slice of the future of the entire, you know, global monetary base. You know, they might be more amenable to it than we'd want to think. And so, I don't know that the fight is always going to be, honestly, I don't always know that it's going to be there. And when it's there, I don't know that it's going to necessarily be over specifically, you know, whether it should exist or not. All of those people, if they're worried about their future, by virtue of them having a concern of their future because of Bitcoin, should only be encouraging them to buy Bitcoin. And if in the future they did not buy Bitcoin and their fears came true, well, now they naturally have less economic power anyway. So, I obviously we can. You know, look at the world right now, and there's lots of concerns over various privacy issues for people in the EU. Things are looking really grim with regards to, you know, are you even allowed to have, you know, run nodes and have keys and stuff like that. That's much more up for debate in the EU, apparently. Which is unfortunate for them. In America, it's pretty soundly understood, I think, that people should be able to run nodes and hold keys. And I think that's going to be a hard one to walk back. And U.S. politicians have a lot to gain from adopting Bitcoin. They become more popular. People love them, which, you know, we don't live in, you know, a perfect constitutional order or anything, but the politicians are still responsible to you know, these popularity contests and you know, being liked by their constituency. So Bitcoin, you know, becoming a Bitcoiner is actually just a great strategy on the individual level. And, you know, as we said before, it's like just on a government level, you know, in order to retain power, it's like you do have to stay solvent enough. And so, you know, there's a lot of things going where they might actually just give in to Bitcoin and become Bitcoiners. Which, you know, would be great. I don't want to say that there's no possibility of bad things, but I do also think that the positive stories don't, or sorry, positive potentials don't get enough play in these discussions.
My favorite thing about Bitcoin is meeting Bitcoiners in person. That's why I'm so excited to tell you guys about what is going on June 14th down in beautiful Tampa Bay, Florida. That's the Sound Money Soiree paired with Bitcoin Day. They're bringing a full day of great talks with amazing speakers like your boy here. And we're topping it off with a black tie event just for you and bring in that hot lady friend. We had Bitcoin cross 100K. We're all getting girlfriends, folks. So come on down to beautiful Tampa, Florida. And if you use the link below, you will get 10% off your entire order, whether you want to go to just the black tie event or black tie event plus Bitcoin Day. You'll get 10% off using the links below. Also, if you're thinking about going to BitBlock Boom in April, if you're going to Vegas in May, or if you're thinking about going to Prague in June, use my promo code GREENCANDLE for all of those. You'll get 10% off your entire order. And come bug me. I hope to see you guys very soon at one of these great in-person events. Enough for me.
Yeah, I mean, the positive potential of you know, being the popularity contest, I guess, aspect of it is now becoming, you know, I guess, increasing for the Bitcoiners, right? I mean, the Bitcoiners used to be a loud minority. Now it seems like, you know, we're kind of creeping up in that. So how big of a role do you think that, you know, I guess Bitcoin is going to play here in the near term because of what we're seeing, you know, kind of the flip on its head in the government, where now it seems like the Bitcoiners have infiltrated the government. So do you think that this is essentially a pivotal moment in history where, you know, we're going to be looking back on this and, you know, maybe decades or something like that and say, hey, you know, that 2024, 2025 was a monumental time just for Bitcoin and for just like general, like the monetary policy in globally.
Yeah, I think it's been huge. We've seen lots of stuff happening at the federal level. Most of it, so far in this administration, seems to be very positive towards Bitcoin, and positive towards Bitcoiners and so on and so forth. Just the sort of industry and Bitcoin economy as a whole. But we also see it at the state level, and many states have been introducing various bills, whether it's their own strategic Bitcoin reserve. Or it's, you know, just bills reaffirming the rights of the residents of those states to be able to use Bitcoin. That has been growing and growing. And so I think, yes, I think we're going to look back and be very excited about, you know, this era as having been a pivotal moment towards people within the government starting to get it. And I would also note that the sort of the discourse around Bitcoin has become much more positive, where there's much less of the sort of Elizabeth Warren anti-crypto army type talk, and it's more like, well, we shouldn't buy that much Bitcoin, or something. You know, it's like it's really shifting the conversation towards not whether we should be like embrace Bitcoin or not, but to what extent, you know, has been the direction where this is going. And that's, I think, very good, because I want them, you know, I'm totally fine with the government just keeping its hands off Bitcoin completely and letting it be a free market thing and not involving themselves and so on and so forth. But if they are going to be into Bitcoin as opposed to outright hostile to Bitcoin, I do think that that's better. I don't think Bitcoiners being in jail is good for Bitcoin.
Now I'm going to have to put you on the spot. I know you're not big for price predictions, but with all this, you know, it's hard to not look at this as a, you know, potential for something to blast off the top with the amount of demand that we have here. So what do you, are you going to give me just a little bit of a price prediction, maybe a range? Do you see us, you know, hitting that exit velocity and essentially starting to swallow up some of that market cap? Because, you know, you mentioned earlier when we discussed $2 trillion, it sounds like a lot, but, you know, gold is over 20 trillion. And we've still got a long way to go for Bitcoin to kind of be the full monetary, you know, network, so to speak. So, yeah, do you got a little bit of a price prediction for me, Bitstein?
I have very little reason to believe that the bull market has ended, and is rather taking a break. So, I mean, higher is my price prediction. But stay humble and stack sats, is the way to go about that, because we don't know when, and we don't know how much. It's also possible that you know, we see like a sort of much more long-term gradual increase in Bitcoin, you know, as it just kind of steadily absorbs things. That's a possibility. And so I don't have the kind of predictions that you want. I think people should focus. I think the time now is not to focus on what the price will be, but just know that there is a bright future ahead, and our job is to go out and get people to also understand why we believe that and why they should be making a Bitcoin a part of their lives.
100%. And I definitely think that's the way we're going to be trending here. But Bitstein, you've been so generous with your time. So why don't you tell people where they can find out more about you and more about the Nakamoto Institute?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Bitstein. You can follow the Nakamoto Institute on Twitter at Nakamoto INST. And go to nakamotoinstitute.org. You can listen to our podcast where we're teaching people about all of the economic ideas that we've sort of based our vision of Bitcoin on, called The Reorg. That's available on whatever streaming platform you're interested in. And if it's not there, let me know and I'll see if I can fix that. But yeah, you can find us there. And yeah, I think that's it.
Awesome. Well, I'll put all that in the show notes as well. So go ahead and check them out. Bitstein's one of the best on Twitter, so make sure to give him a follow. And yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here. And you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me.